This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. And the Florence County Museum, presenting Kindred Spirit, The Personal Worlds of William H. Johnson, exploring the painter's artistic evolution and journey of self-discovery from rural South Carolina to Europe and New York, flocomuseum.org. And the Charleston Gilliard Center, presenting in partnership with Buxton Books, a conversation with author Eric Larson on the launch of his new book, The Demon of Unrest, Thursday, May 16th. More information at gilliardcenter.org.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Alfred Turner, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Walter and I will be talking with author Kevin Duffus about his book, The 1768 Charleston Lighthouse, Finding the Light in the Fog of History. Charleston's first lighthouse was established on Middle Bay Island in 1768. The history of that lighthouse, however, has been lost in a fog of misinformation. Kevin Duffus conducted extensive research for his book and has been able to reconstruct the history of America's seventh lighthouse. He recently sat down with Walter Edgar and me to tell us the story.
Kevin, really appreciate your driving in from the North Carolina mountains to be with us today on the Journal. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about you? You know, who are you? Where'd you go to school? How'd you get interested in lighthouses and that kind of thing?
Who are your folks?
Yeah.
Well, I was a dependent of an Air Force officer, a D-Day veteran pilot, and we lived in various states and also in the Far East during my formative years. I really took an interest in maritime matters when we flew across the Pacific Ocean. And at the same time, I was reading National Geographic magazines about Robin Lee Graham, the first teenager to sail around the world alone. And I was also influenced by stories of Jacques Cousteau and his adventures. I actually learned probably as much from National Geographic's as I did in the classroom. And it instilled in me an interest and passion for maritime history. And my father's last assignment was at East Carolina University in Greenville in eastern North Carolina. And I was 15 years old and found it hard to be accepted in the high school community among students who had been together since kindergarten. So I started spending a lot of time at the county library, much to my mother's surprise and appreciation. And so there I began to pull off the shelf a number of books about the history of specifically the Outer Banks of North Carolina. A couple of books written by a historian named David Stick, who I couldn't have imagined then that he and I would someday become best friends and he would be my mentor.
Well, and also you then went to Chapel Hill, right?
No, I actually went to NC State to study architecture.
Okay. Oh, that explains a lot of things. But you earlier, before we went on the air, you mentioned Bill Powell, who was the dean of North Carolina history at the University of North Carolina and a longtime friend of mine before he passed.
Yes. So I ended up leaving architecture. It wasn't quite what I expected it to be in the early 1970s, at least the design school at NC State. And so I'd already started working at the local television station to help my father pay my tuition. And television seduced me from a higher education. The excitement of TV, especially in the early days of broadcasting and television. And I happened to be fortunate enough to work for a television station that was very much involved in pioneering productions. I worked for a station that sent me to England six times over 3 years for North Carolina's 400th anniversary between 1984 and 1987, and documenting the voyages, the Walter Raleigh voyages to Roanoke Island. Mm-hmm. And that's when I became familiar with Bill Powell. He was very much a part of our productions with his knowledge of the early history of North Carolina.
Okay. All right, Kevin, let's move on to you've published a number of books, but the one we're specifically interested in today, the 1768 Charleston Lighthouse, Finding the Light in the Fog of History. You've already mentioned you were in architecture, and having read your book, it explains a lot about how this book developed. But how did you specifically get into the Charleston Lighthouse? Yeah, there's a lighthouse on Morris Island now, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about the one built during the colonial period.
That's correct. And this particular lighthouse was the seventh lighthouse built in colonial America. It was the tallest at the time that it was built and was for a number of years afterward. I've also written that it is architecturally was the most unique lighthouse in America. And its architectural lineage is what I think is most fascinating about this story.
Let's just jump into that. Charleston was one of the major ports in colonial America, but they didn't have a lighthouse as we think of. They had beacons of sorts, just sort of a torch that you would have at night, but that was not to guide people in necessarily, was it?
No, and actually that's one of the, so when I began to research this subject, and I came in through the back door because I had in 2016, I was researching a book that I was commissioned to write on the history of Cape Fear and Bald Head Island. And in the process of working on that book, I came across a document at the National Archives that described North Carolina's first lighthouse and its architectural specifications. This was written by the Secretary of Treasury. This in 1893, the Secretary of Treasury actually hired contractors directly to build the nation's lighthouses. And in reading this document, I noticed some information that made me realize I had seen a similar lighthouse in a Civil War illustration, and that turned out to be this 1768 Charleston lighthouse. And so that led me down this rabbit hole of seeking information about Charleston's first lighthouse. But you're right that many books on the history of navigation in the harbor and port of Charleston all say that going back as far as 1680, that there were efforts to guide ships into port using flames of some sort.
Which they call beacons, but you know, it's not what we think of as a beacon.
No, those beacons were actually, and they weren't put into service as early as 1680. It was a number of years after that. But those were signal beacons or warning beacons. Those were to alert the town that there were enemy ships offshore, and specifically Spanish ships. And so the government actually funded a number of beacons all the way down the coast of South Carolina, the colony of South Carolina. So writers have misconstrued that information and have assumed that those beacons were actually some sort of aid to navigation. And I can assure you, I also have been a sailor all my life, and I've sailed offshore between the Windward Islands and as far north as Rhode Island. And I can tell you that a feeble flame on the beach is not going to convince a ship captain to attempt to risk his ship and his cargo and his passengers to try to enter what was a very circuitous ship channel coming into Charleston Harbor. Most people don't realize it isn't where it is today. It was about 3 miles south near the north end of Folly Beach. And that was the entrance to Charleston Harbor in the 18th century. And so it was not until 1750 that there was a serious effort to mark the entrance to Charleston Harbor. Savannah had already, or Tybee Island Lighthouse had already been established at that point. So South Carolina was a little bit behind its neighboring colonies. Even North Carolina had markers or beacons that were marking the entrances to a couple of the ports before Charleston got around to establishing navigation.
And you know, that really is surprising given the commercial importance of Charleston as a port. And as you mentioned, the circuitous way to get in, because now when people come into Charleston Harbor, the straight shot, but that has to do with a 19th century improvement with the jetties. So why they didn't have it, it's really interesting. They certainly could have afforded it. It was the richest colony in North America. They could have afforded it. That was not an issue. But it took them until, as you say, the 1760s to seriously look at putting a lighthouse as a beacon for navigation.
Well, and oddly enough, in 1750, there was an appropriation to try to establish some sort of marker or aid to navigation for ships entering Charleston Harbor. But that money was siphoned off by the construction of St. Michael's Church, which then, of course, brings us into the architectural lineage between this lighthouse built in 1768 and this magnificent church, which was built by the same man, Samuel Carty.
Kevin, that's what I found absolutely fascinating. So let's dive right into the steeple, the tower and steeple of St. Michael's. The architect for both was an Irish immigrant, and he got the contract to build St. Michael's fairly early after he got here. You do delve into who was the architect, which people have been debating that for 300 years almost. So let's get into that story.
Well, and my discovery of this document at the National Archives concerning the Cape Fear Lighthouse described the shape of the lighthouse as being the base of it being 32 feet square, this platform that was 20 feet high. There was not another lighthouse in America, and there hasn't been one since that an octagonal tower that sat on top of this square platform. And once I started researching the Charleston Lighthouse, I realized that the architect of that lighthouse was Samuel Carty. And then I, of course, learned that Samuel Carty had designed – he may not have designed the sanctuary of St. Michael's, but he certainly designed the steeple, the bell tower and the steeple, which essentially sat on a square platform exactly like his lighthouse did. Samuel Carty, of course, came from Dublin, Ireland, and was very familiar with a number of the churches and cathedrals there, especially St. Patrick's, which the bell tower there was very similar, very square, massive base, walls that were 5 feet thick. Well, it just so happens that the base of the steeple of St. Michael's Church, which is exactly 32 feet square, just like the lighthouse at Cape Fear, has walls that are 5 feet thick. So it makes sense that this was the formula that he used, he was familiar with. He knew how to build a church. He had never built a lighthouse before. And at that time, as I said, there were only six other lighthouses in colonial America at that time, and none of them were like what was going to be built out on what was then called Middle Bay Island, which is, of course, now the submerged Morris Island.
And we're building in downtown Charleston, and St. Michael's is built on Meeting Street, which is sort of a high ground, but most of Charleston was pretty boggy. So he had to put down a tremendous foundation to support that tower.
And that's an interesting point, too, because I did a great deal of research into the building because I wanted to understand, because there are no documents or records that can tell us anything about the construction of the 1768 Charleston Lighthouse. We know it existed. I mean, there are lots of – there's sources of information that tell us about it many years later. But I wanted to understand what sort of foundation he may have built underneath the lighthouse, which had to have been substantial, had to have been stone. And again, in comparison, the Cape Fear Lighthouse was built using the same plans that Carty used to build the Charleston Lighthouse. They made one mistake. They cut corners up in North Carolina by placing it on a brick foundation that was only 4 feet thick. It was very precarious. Carty, I'm almost certain, without any additional documentation, built the Charleston Lighthouse on a stone foundation.
Now, where is he going to get that? We don't have much natural stone here. You've got coquina on the coast. We know they were importing stones, paving stones, not so much for building, but came in as ballast, and regular connection with Bermuda, where you could get Bermuda stone, which is pretty sturdy. And we've seen the ruins of the lighthouse we're talking about after it was blown up, huge pieces of stone.
Correct. Well, that again, there are no records that will tell us that, but we do know that St. Michael's Church, the stone was brought in from England. It was Portland stone. It was a limestone somewhat similar to the Bermuda limestone that was also coming into the port. So there was a great deal of stone being brought in. I discovered another interest or curiosity, and that's that in 1963, when the Historic American Buildings Survey was being done, there was a very extensive document written describing the structure of St. Michael's Church, and there's not a single word in there about the foundation. In fact, the only reference that I could find pertaining to the St. Michael's steeple foundation came after the Charleston earthquake. One of the foundation stones was exposed, and there's a great deal of excitement because at that time they thought maybe that was the cornerstone, that they may have found a stone that would have information inscribed on it. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case. But they did that. That's the only mention that I could find anywhere in the sources of any type of stone foundation. But that steeple, of course, which was considerably taller, by the way, than Samuel Carty's lighthouse out at Middle Bay Island. That lighthouse, when it was completed, the focal plane of where the light was about 96 feet above the ground. And I think the steeple of St. Michael's is somewhere in the vicinity of 180 feet. Mm-hmm. They both had a tremendous amount of weight pressing down on the foundation. So both of them had to have had a pretty substantial foundation.
So how deep of a foundation do you have any idea?
Well, we have examples from other lighthouses. So also to understand and to be able to write a complete story about this particular lighthouse, I had to research a number of other lighthouses from that time in terms of their dimensions. The cost that was a very important factor in researching this story because I have to back up and say that when I started, I discovered that there was a tremendous amount of misinformation about Charleston's first lighthouse. There is a variance in terms of the numbers of lighthouses that preceded the modern day or the current Morris Island Lighthouse. There is disagreement among writers and historians as to the locations of those lighthouses. Then there are differences in terms of the heights and the dates that it was built. And I had to sift through all of this. I describe it as trying to untangle this Gordian knot of errors and repetition among historians who tend to just simply repeat the same facts over and over again. And I can share with you what I believe was the source of all this misinformation. But so back to the question, what would the depth be? When the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse was built between 1798 and 1803, the specifications called for the foundation to be buried 9 feet deep into the beach. And I know from experience that in certain places on the coast on these barrier islands, if you dig a hole about 9 feet deep, you will end up hitting sand that is so compacted that it almost is like concrete. It's almost like rock. I have no doubt that Samuel Carty, you know, knowing he was going to build this structure that was going to weigh maybe 4,000 tons, that he had to build it on a stable surface.
Before we go any further, I want to just sidetrack you. You were talking about the source of all the misinformation that got woven into the historical record. You think you know where it started?
Yes. So there have been in the past 20 years or so, a number of magazine articles, books written about South Carolina's lighthouses, and the same stories get repeated over and over. You've already mentioned the beacons, which in my book, I refer to them as fireballs of pitch and oakum. That gets repeated over and over. All of this came from a book edited by a man named Arthur Mazeek. So in 1886, he published the Charleston Yearbook, and in that yearbook, he had a number of pages devoted to aids to navigation for Charleston Harbor, and he wrote a couple of paragraphs talking about the Colonial Lighthouse, but he very quickly transitioned into a description of lighthouses in general. This is where the misconception about beacons and fireballs of Pitchin' Oakum being the first lights on at Charleston Harbor.
And of course, the 1768 lighthouse did not exist when he was writing this.
Correct. You know, that's, you bring up an interesting, a good point, and that is that the United States government in 1858 published what they call the Light List, which was a very comprehensive list of all of the lighthouses and beacons in America at that time. There were 490 listings of lighthouses, beacons, lightships, and so forth, marking the coast of America. There was only one that the government had no confidence in stating when it was originally built, and that was the Charleston Lighthouse. So even then, of course, there was confusion about it. Arthur Mazeek said that the Charleston Lighthouse was established in 1767. And that's not correct. It was, the construction started in 1767. A lighthouse doesn't become a lighthouse until the lights start shining for the very first time.
Okay. All right. Now, Mr. Carty moves out to Morris Island. Literally, he moves out there and lives there and employs enslaved labor to build the lighthouse, right?
Correct.
Okay. And how long does it take him to complete the lighthouse?
Well, and so in writing this book, and again, there was very little information about the lighthouse except for what I could find in newspapers. So I researched newspapers from 1767, 1768, and I discovered that the cornerstone was laid in May of 1767. That was a big deal.
I was going to say, absolutely.
Oddly enough, the newspapers did a really good job of reporting the periodic progress of the lighthouse. The following summer in July, the paper wrote that the tower was nearing completion, that Carty was about to raise the lantern on top, the lantern being the enclosed room, not the light, not what we would call a lantern today, but a lighthouse lantern is the glass enclosed structure that sat on the top of the masonry tower.
And it is wooden.
Yes, in 1768, that was the best they could do, was wood. Twice it caught fire, and the second time that the lantern caught fire, the fire went all the way down the tower, burned the entire stairway, all the window frames, and all of that had to be rebuilt.
This is fascinating because I want to talk about the lantern and what kind of lights, because you've got incredible illustrations in your book. When people talked about lighthouses, they talked about candle power, measuring beams. Well, they actually were burning candles in the lighthouse. And let's describe that fixture, if we could, Kevin.
Sure. The very early light source for this lighthouse, but also lighthouses in England at the time, there was a very famous lighthouse called Eddystone Lighthouse on the coast of England that was built, the first one was built in late 1600s. They used tallow candles. Inside this glass enclosed room at the top of the lighthouse, there was a chandelier or candelabra that would hold 24 candles. There were 16 on the lower rung and then 8 on the upper. This was all hung by a chain, and the keeper, when he went on duty at night, he would lower everything down so he could take his taper and light all the candles and then hoist it back up. There was not a lot of room between the chandelier and the glass windows. So moving around up there in the lantern room was required really the balance of an acrobat, being able to move around. And that's why I believe there were a couple times where candles would be bumped and it would start a fire.
Okay. Now, just because he lights the candles, that isn't the end of his mission at night. Being a lighthouse keeper was a very difficult job because those candles, you had to keep trimming the wicks and replacing the candles. So literally, he was up most of the night. Now, you have found out, because through your sources, that certainly within a few years, it was an enslaved person who was taking care of the lighting, correct?
During certain times when that keeper had enslaved persons within their household. But there were other keepers like the man named St. Lo Melanchthon II, who was the longest serving keeper at the Charleston Lighthouse for 26 years, and he had no slave labor. But yes, I have an entire chapter in the book devoted to my research into enslaved lighthouse keepers. Yeah, it was a tough job for a lighthouse keeper, especially that first keeper, which, by the way, I can't tell you who it was. I think that it was possibly a man named Thomas Hollingsby, who was the keeper in 1789 after the Revolution, when the lighthouse was absorbed by the federal government.
We need to remind folks that until after the Revolution, the lighthouse was South Carolina's responsibility, not that of the folks back in London. Once we have a United States, it becomes part of the United States government's responsibility. That, the Customs House, all of those become federal properties in South Carolina, which are going to play into the story in 1860. And also, after the federal government takes over, more modern sources of illumination become available. Let's talk about those French lenses that come in that become part of the story also in 1860-61.
Sure. I just wanted to say, too, about lighthouse keepers. So when the Charleston Lighthouse was first established, there were only seven it was the seventh lighthouse. There were only seven lighthouse keepers. They only had one man hired to operate this lighthouse 365 days a year, all night long. There were no vacations. There were no there was no such thing as a weekend or time off or sick days. If a keeper was sick, usually their wife, or if they did have enslaved men within their household, that they would operate the lighthouse. But it was a tough job in storms and all sorts of difficult conditions. But as far as the lighting source goes, so we go from tallow candles when the federal government took over. Then they started using these oil lamps. They called them pan lamps, but they were basically wicks that were sat in a pan of oil. And the reason for that was that you could light these and the oil would last a lot longer than the tallow candles. And it was marginally brighter. By 1816, most U.S. lighthouses were converted to the system of parabolic reflectors and oil lamps. There was a man named Winslow who got this federal contract to install these reflectors. And so in the Charleston Lighthouse, there were 16 lamps and reflectors that were pointing in different directions that sat on this iron frame that would then rotate. There was a clockwork system that was put in, and with weights descending inside the tower, and those actually rotated the light so then it would flash, which was for Charleston was not a good thing because the lighthouse was also trying to guide ships into this very narrow, dangerous channel. And when the light eclipsed, the captain or the navigator suddenly couldn't see the lighthouse, and that was a bit disconcerting when there are waves crashing on both sides of your ship. From there, in 1822, a man named Augustin Fresnel, who was a French physicist, a young man actually, developed this lens that used a single light source. That, you know, that often is not mentioned by lighthouse historians. That really the genius behind Fresnel's lens is that instead of having 16 or 20 or more oil lamps, which are all burning oil, Fresnel came up with this system so that there was a single lamp in the middle of this barrel-shaped lens, which his first Fresnel lens was a combination of prisms and magnifying glasses and then mirrors, which was eventually refined by the Stevenson family of Scotland, which produced Robert Louis Stevenson, so that we ended up with what's we all know now today as a Fresnel lens. There were a number of different sizes of Fresnel lenses. So the biggest ones were used for what we call seacoast lights, which were the biggest, tallest lights, the lights that needed to be seen the farthest distance at sea. Cape Hatteras was a great example. Cape Hatteras was marking Diamond Shoals. So it had what we call a first-order Fresnel lens. It was the largest. A first-order Fresnel lens is 12 feet tall. It's 6 feet wide. It consists of over 1,000 crown crystal prisms. It's an absolutely beautiful invention of the Victorian era. Here at Charleston, we had a second order Fresnel lens that was brought in 1857 and installed. The lighthouse had to be renovated then. It was heightened by some 20-some feet or so. And then the second order Fresnel lens was placed in a new lantern room. It was an absolutely magnificent development in lighting lighthouses. In fact, there are still a number of lighthouses that operate with Fresnel lenses in them. This device that was created in the 1850s, and it is still just as functional today as it was then.
This is 1857. 3 years later, in December, South Carolina secedes from the Union. And I wanted to read what the governor said. There was a statement concerning federal property. "It is nevertheless proposed and will be confirmed by this convention that the state of South Carolina will relinquish all claim, right, and title to any and all of the property of the United States without the limits of the said state, and that the United States shall surrender to the state of South Carolina all the property of the United States within the limits of that state and its maritime jurisdiction. The property of the United States referred to is in part all forts, arsenals, magazines, and depots of arms, naval stations, revenue establishments, including lighthouses, lightships, beacons, all vessels attached to that service, customs houses, etc. So the 1768 lighthouse is now to become South Carolina property. And within a few months, it is Confederate government, are concerned about, we don't want a lighthouse anymore.
True. Well, and actually, it wasn't just the Confederate government. Charleston, a number of figures from the Charleston area had a profound sort of impact on the Confederacy. And one of them was Christopher Memminger, who was the Secretary of Treasury for the Confederacy. And of course, he was very close friends with Governor Pickens and William Colcock, who he nominated to be the collector of customs for Charleston Harbor. And Colcock became the man responsible for the lighthouses and beacons and lightships and so forth. And yes, Memminger sent out letters from Richmond saying that we, to all of the southern states, that we want, your lighthouse keepers and lighthouse inspectors to extinguish their lighthouses because we don't want our lighthouses to guide the ships of the Union Navy. So there was this frenetic activity of machinists going out to the coast in these lighthouses to not only extinguish the light, they eventually realized that there was a very good possibility that the coast was going to be lost to Union forces. And they didn't want the Union to be able to reestablish the lighthouses very easily. So then the orders were sent out, again, from Secretary Memminger, to actually have the Fresnel lenses dismantled and physically removed from the lighthouse property so that when the lighthouse was captured by Union forces, that they wouldn't be able to get it operating again.
Now, we're talking about a fairly big piece of machinery, right?
The Fresnel lens in the Charleston Lighthouse probably weighed around 4,500 pounds. So these machines, these lenses, were designed and constructed in Paris, all of them were, by various, about three or four different manufacturers in Paris. But they could be dismantled in components or sections. I did research at the National Archives for this book and found the lighthouse keeper's handwritten inventory of all of the items that had to be removed from the lighthouse upon the orders from Memminger to Collector Colcock. And all of this material had to be removed from the lighthouse and then transported to the new custom building in Charleston.
Which still stands.
Which still stands. They thought that it would be safe. This very fragile, delicate equipment was all boxed up. In many cases, they were placed in cotton-lined pine crates. In 1863, when the Custom House was beginning to receive shells fired from Morris Island and also St. Michael's Church, there was a great fear that, of course, the bells of St. Michael's Church would be damaged in this shelling of the city. So they were all removed except for the tenor bell. and put on a railroad car. And even though I was not able to find direct evidence to state with 100% certainty that the Fresnel lenses from the harbor were also placed on that railroad car, but based on the evidence in other states and the orders that were being sent out by Christopher Memminger, it's almost certain that those Fresnel lenses were sent to Columbia.
For safekeeping.
For safekeeping, yes. That would be an absolute safe place. And just as they were – just as what happened in North Carolina in Raleigh with the lenses being stored in the Capitol building, I believe that the Fresnel lenses, including the 1768 Charleston Lighthouse Fresnel – second order Fresnel lens, were placed in the State House. This was the original, the 1790 State House, which was not as commodious as the North Carolina Capitol building was because it predated it by quite a number of years, and it was mostly built of wood. And so but it did have a basement.
Yes, it was on a raised basement.
And so I suggested or conjectured that those lenses were probably stored in the basement where they were very safe for the next 3 years.
Well, and of course, then after Sherman's visit in February 1865, we know what happened to St. Michael's bells. Some were severely damaged, some were not, but they were in the fire that destroyed downtown Columbia. So I want to jump back, though, to 1861, because the shelling of Charleston was possible because Morris Island became occupied by federal troops. What did the Confederates do before they abandoned Morris Island?
So in the summer of 1861, a very small committee of men, including the Secretary of the Navy and the representative of the U.S. Coast Survey and also an Army engineer, all met to discuss how they might be able to interfere with the commerce of the major ports of the South, Charleston being at the top of the list. How can they stop trade continuing? And so the strategy was formed to try to actually physically block or clog the entrance to the channel. This was not a new strategy. This is – you can go back to Roman times and find instances where this was a military strategy.
This is called the Stone Fleet, right?
Correct. So the idea was formed for the U.S. government to purchase a number of derelict whaling ships, a couple of dozen that were all in harbor in New England ports, but were no longer in service. So that was done, and this fleet was sailed down to the Port Royal area, and then the plan was to sail them up to the entrance to Ship Channel leading into Charleston Harbor and to punch holes in the bottom and sink them right in the main channel. And so in December of 1861, this is what in fact happened. This large fleet of ships were coming up from the south. It just so happened that December 18th, 1861, there was a full moon. There had already been discussions in Charleston, what are we going to do if something like this happens? We can't allow the lighthouse. And by the way, it wasn't just the lighthouse. There was a smaller beacon called a range marker or beacon that sat on the beach that could be used to align the two structures, the lighthouse in the back and the beacon in front. And when you had those two lights in a line, then that marked the entrance to the channel. So a very unfortunate decision was made that the lighthouse had to be destroyed.
Because the Confederates did withdraw from Morris Island, there were several ferocious battles that you do discuss, but the Confederates had to withdraw. They simply could not hold out any longer, and they withdrew in the middle of the night. After they withdrew, they decided to make sure that the Yankees couldn't use the lighthouse.
Correct. So they did, in fact, put enough gunpowder in there to bring the entire tower down, which was an absolute tragedy. That's where the expression "all for naught" by Melville comes from, because he used it in reference to the loss of this magnificent whaling fleet. All of these ships had a great history of whaling in the Pacific, and I think one of the ships was the ship that Moby Dick was written about. So these two great icons of American maritime history, the New England whaling fleet and the Charleston Lighthouse, this magnificent architectural masterpiece. What a loss. That lighthouse, I contend, would still be standing today. It was built so well had it not been blown up on that night. By the way, I know almost exactly where the submerged and now buried ruins of the 1768 lighthouse are, and I hope that in the coming months we'll be able to make an announcement about having located it, because I found some very, very specific evidence in the National Archives that have helped us locate the site.
Is that something you're working with the archaeologists at the university, or is this a private?
It's actually a private company, but it's actually based here in Columbia, an ocean science and engineering firm that are working in that general vicinity on some other projects.
Well, the ruins of that lighthouse were fairly substantial, because you do have a photograph, a Civil War photograph, showing men around, and there's still this huge pile of rubble.
Yeah, and that's the other sad thing about this story, is the lighthouse was destroyed so it would not mark the entrance to the channel, but the pile of ruins remained there, and they were 20, 30 feet high in places, and massive blocks of brick and stone. And so for the remainder of the war and for many years after, that pile remained there and clearly could still be used to mark the entrance to Ship Channel. So
can you say irony?
Yeah. It's well, there are lots of there have been a lot of mistakes made in wars. Mm. That was one of the unfortunate ones. I wish that lighthouse was still there. But as I wrote in the book, we still have Samuel Carty's steeple at St. Michael's Church to be able to admire his genius.
Yeah. Gentlemen, I have to say this. We're well over time. We need to wrap up.
Well, Kevin, any last words for our listeners?
Well, thank you. It's a great honor to be here and to be speaking with you. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to share my knowledge of this little-known architectural wonder of the South Carolina coast.
It's quite a story. So, Kevin Duffus, thank you so much for being with us today on The Journal.
I hope you enjoyed today's journal. It was a pleasure having Kevin Duffus join us to tell the story of Charleston's Colonial Lighthouse. Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. Remember, the views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters. New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.